better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
We are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3552 of the Survival Podcast. It snuck right up on me that it is Wednesday because we had Monday off. I don't have a lot of off days, and I guess I do have Fridays off, so I had like a four-day weekend, and now I'm paying for it on the other side. But we got a good one set up for you today. I'm going to bring a guest on in just a moment, and we're going to be talking about food clubs and food hubs and how you can use that to assert sovereignty in your life over one of the most important things humans do, which is choose the food that they consume. And if you've paid attention at all lately, there seems to be a hell of a lot of upset people on both sides of this argument. The corporations that want to control us are angry that people are starting to ask, you know, questions like, Why are we eating food with this industrial toxic ick in it? And why do we have these ingredients in our food that are literally illegal in almost every other modern nation in the world? They don't like being asked questions like that. They want you to shut up and listen to the experts. And then there's people that are asking those questions. They're starting to get upset about how hard it is to actually find affordable food and nutritious, healthy food and the right information. And there is a concerted effort, I believe, by the establishment to keep everybody shopping at giant stores and buying the chemical food and spending most of their time in the center of the food store where the food is preserved long-term with chemicals and in a box. And we really need to be eating food closer to its natural state. And Joshua's going to be on in just a moment with us to talk about how he set up a food club in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and how that's going, and how you can emulate what he's doing wherever you are. We will not get too glossy, but at some point we'll even talk about there are, not everything is rosy, and there may be some cons to this approach, and we'll talk about those. We'll talk about how you have to interact or not interact with the state and a bunch of other things. And we'll even draw an analogy to how the early church created its own parallel systems and how Joshua's built what he's doing modeling that. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. And hey, speaking of food, I'll tell you what, if you want to have just an awesome food experience, get on over to Anton's Land of Biltong, where he makes biltong the old school way. I did confirm with Anton today he will be teaching at the workshop in November. If you get to come, you'll get to learn from Anton, and you'll get to sample his biltong. But you do not have to wait that long. You can order right now. You can order one off. You can order a subscription service. I get my subscription once or twice a month, once every 2 weeks. I get a package in of biltong and Duwar sausages. If you try it, you'll end up just as addicted as I am. In fact, yesterday, I literally ate biltong and Duwars for dinner because I didn't feel like cooking anything. And it was a fantastic meal. Check him out at Anton's Land of Biltong. Next up today, hey, you want to build your wealth, you want to check out the Wealth Steading Podcast with John Pugliano. John has been working with us going back to 2010, so that's 14 years he's been working with the Survival Podcast, been on interviews, and serving as an expert council member. He's a fantastic investment manager, and his podcast will tell you what he's looking at in the market right now. His latest episode, published just a few days ago, Lamborghini Income and Toyota Lifestyle. You want to know more about that? Check out the Wealth Steading Podcast with John Pugliano. And now, real quick, before I bring our guest on, you know, I talk to you guys all the time about why you should be on either like the Telegram channel or group, or why you should be, on our daily mail and also social media and all that. But you know, if you're following me on Twitter or Gab or MeWe or wherever, you may not see what I post because of algorithms, and just you may not be using it when I post, right? So I get knocked down in the timeline or whatever. If you get on the Daily Mail, you'll get the mail every day, so you'll definitely get it. But sometimes things are time sensitive, and that's why the Telegram channel, if you don't want the group and all the conversation, the channel's great. When I find something out, I drop it in that channel instantly. And if you're on the group, you don't need to be on both because anything that goes in the channel goes to the group. Yesterday, I got an email while we were live streaming, so I could not work this into the show. Well, if you don't know what a plasma cutter is, think of it like a torch that's dedicated to cut metal. That's all it's for, is for cutting. That's why it's called a plasma cutter. They work with in combination with an air compressor, and they are a really great tool. They're one of those tools that you don't really realize how valuable they are until you own one. And this one here was on sale for $100. And it was such a good deal. I sent it to my buddy David. He said, is that even real? I personally think, I thought yesterday what it was is they were discontinuing them and getting rid of them. And that's why. But today they're back up to $200. And I think that somebody either from the vendor or from Amazon made a mistake and it was our benefit. I ordered one of these before I even told anybody about it. And this morning I'm like, man, I hope I get to tell people on air about this. Nope, $199.99, so it doubled in price overnight, and I don't even know when that actually happened. What I'll tell you is if had you been on the Telegram group or the Daily Mail, you would have had a shot at one of these. And maybe this one's not that big of a deal to you. Maybe you don't really care. It's not your thing. I get that. But what I'm going to tell you is you never know what I'm going to find. I have feelers out everywhere. This one came from an audience member. So if you want to stay connected in and not miss things like that, that's one of the reasons to get on some level of direct communication with us so that we can let you know. We'll also do things like say, hey, the live stream today is going to be about and things like that as well. All right, with that, let's go ahead and bring our special guest on, Joshua. Joshua, welcome to the Survival Podcast, bro.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you having me on.
Hey, when I got this application, I was excited because I like this topic. And I've wanted to do more on private membership associations at the same time. I think they're a valuable tool, but I also think there's some people out there that are overselling them a bit. So having somebody that's integrated one into an active running business, I think will be really advantageous here. But before we dig into this topic, can we talk about how did you even get interested in this world, right? Like, let's go back to before you were, whenever that was, and you're going along about your life, maybe eating Doritos or something, I don't know. And you one day decide, I want to eat better food, and then how does it lead you to getting actively involved? I would call you an activist, obviously.
Okay. Yeah, so that goes way back, I guess, probably 10 years ago or so. I had a normal job, actually a government job, and basically did nothing but listen to podcasts and audiobooks all day for 8 hours a day every day, and got into investing. And so realized that I did not have a very good education. I didn't know much about the world, politics, economics, none of it. So that led down many rabbit holes, of course. And I went into Austrian economics and libertarianism and all the way into anarchism and agorism and all the isms. And in the meantime, did everything from economics to history to health and natural health, all these different things. And around that time, I actually started my own podcast. I realized that there's all this information out there, but it was taking me 8 hours a day for 2 years just to kind of understand what all this meant. And there's no place where it was like compiled together. And I guess there's probably more places now, but then there wasn't. And so I started that, and then that led me down even more rabbit trails. And then we also bought a property that was 2 acres, and we started kind of homesteading, kind of hobby homesteading, where we started some gardens, and we had chickens, we tried some pigs, we tried sheep, I planted orchards, food forests, just all the stuff. And then permaculture is one of the rabbit trails, so it was all on a kind of permaculture kind of atmosphere there. And in the meantime, I was also learning about how corrupt all the systems are, and one of those was the food system. And so learning about seed oils and how the correlation between seed oils and all of our modern health issues is more directly related than sugar and anything else. It's pretty much a direct one-for-one correlation, which is crazy. And then just also just all the stuff that's in your meat, the fact they feed chicken poop to the cows by covering it molasses. And it's a great business decision. And well, maybe, but that's super unhealthy and I would not eat that.
Yeah.
And then all the stuff they put in them and the chemicals and all the stuff that's just even the organic label. So I learned all about this stuff. And at the same time, I was kind of going down the whole libertarian anarchist type trail there. And ended up starting a group in my local area. Probably most of your people have heard of Freedom Cells. And so we started on there and then expanded out, and we had a like-minded group of people that started meeting around the first year of COVID. So I guess that's maybe 4 years ago or however long that was. And so we started meeting once a month, started to meet a lot of folks that were very like-minded. They wanted to be more outside the system. We were all into things like homeschooling and homesteading and natural health and all of this. And so out of that, I, again, was working a government job, wasn't super satisfied with my work. And me and another guy in that group ended up wanting to do a business together of some sort. And we decided, we eventually came to the idea of starting what is now the Agora, which was our first idea was centered around this idea of a food club. And so there's a guy in Kentucky, John Moody, was the one that we kind of saw as the only one of its type that we knew of. And so we saw that he was doing something that was basically an outside of the system food operation. And it was one that we thought we could do here, and we could truly be acting outside the system as well as building a local food system here. We could be more resilient. We could build that community. We can do all these things all together. We can help people with health issues, all this stuff. And so that's what we ended up doing. And that was probably 4 years ago when we, maybe 3 years ago, I guess, when we actually started that. And then the food club opened up shortly after that. And ever since then, we've been just slowly, very slowly building and getting that going as something that now is an actual working thing. And we have all kinds of members that come and get their weekly groceries from us. We have all kinds of suppliers. A lot of them are members themselves. And we've built this this economy, more circular, agorist economy, that we've been able to set up in a way that is outside of the system. We don't have to deal with the state and everything that comes with that. And we have built this this community and this circular system where the money flows in a circular pattern. The suppliers are involved. The members are involved. The community's involved. And everybody is working in a way that's synergistic and helps each other around this hub that we've built, where we now have the food club. We have classes. We've got Bible studies. We've got various things going on. Some are in the works. Some are actively going on. We've got gardens. Just all different kinds of things that we've been able to integrate together, and lots of plans for the future. So hopefully in the next few years, that just continues to grow. But it's something that we have actively, actually been doing for probably about 3 years now.
And for people that are, you know, just learning about this, can you explain what a food club is? I mean, it seems kind of self-explanatory. It involves food and a club. I mean, we all had clubhouses when we were little kids, and you know, stay out, big kids or whatever. It's a little different than that, though. Can you just kind of explain the basics of what a food club is and how it operates?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, the idea is that it's a members-only organization, and it can be set up many different ways. So the way we set it up is not necessarily how it has to be. But in general, you have an organization set up where members join up. And then the food club itself is ran by representatives, or an actual, you could say, a business leader or CEO, again, depending on how formally you set up the structure. And then what happens is that the members place orders, or again, you could do that other ways. And the representatives have connections with local suppliers, and they go out and get the food. They have deliveries. We can do wholesale orders. You can do bulk orders, all kinds of stuff. We basically, the idea is we get all this food into a physical location, and we do it once a week. Some people, when they start off once a month or something. But we do it once a week. We bring all the food together, and then members can come in. We're open a few days a week. They physically come in. They pick up stuff they ordered. They pick up other things off the shelf that they want. They ideally are getting their groceries, the majority of their groceries, through us, and they go on about their way. And so one of the, I guess, beauties of the way this is set up is that it is set up on an account basis. So every member, when they come and sign up to be a member of the food club, they start an account and they put money in that account. And so what we do is we take a portion of those funds every week to pay for the things that we get every week to supply everybody. And so in doing so, we are providing a service, and we have a service model. So if you think of Grubhub or a company like that, they are not actively buying a meal from Olive Garden, marking it up and reselling it to you, and then responsible for all the liabilities in selling food.
Yeah.
No, they're providing a service, picking up your food for you that you ordered, bringing it to you, and they charge a service fee for that.
It's a taxi for your meatball sub.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So we have a similar model set up as a food club model where we go out, we get the food, we vet the suppliers, we have the connections, we bulk all these orders together and all this money together, all the members together, and we get that stuff for them. We provide that service. And then when members come and pick up their stuff every week, they're truly just picking up stuff. They are not buying anything from us. We're not selling anything to them. We use their own money, and it's already paid for. Everything in the food club is already paid for with member money. So the association of members as a whole already owns all that stuff. So without the sales, we don't have to deal with sales tax. If there's taxes, we pay it when we get the stuff. We don't have to deal with the regulation on selling something like, say, raw milk and other things that are very dicey and very covered with regulations. Because we don't sell that stuff. It's actually illegal in our state to sell that unless you go through the herd share, pet food laws, or whatever it is. Okay. And so we are set up on this food club model where it makes a way for us to come together, build this community of members, this private association of members, and we can provide their weekly groceries as a service in a way that, again, keeps us mostly outside of the system. And again, there's a lot of different ways someone could theoretically set up something like that, but that's the basics of the food club model.
So talk about why you made the decision to make this a members program. So like, if you're not a member, sorry. Now you can join from, I looked at your website, you want to be a member, here's how you be a member, fill this out, give us, you know, your membership fees. But if you're not a member, sorry, you're not able to do business with us.
Yeah, that's one of the cons in a way, but also one of the pros at the same time. So we set it up as a private membership association, or the idea is a PMA, and those, yes, have gotten super popular since COVID hit, where everybody was all worried about their freedoms and freaking out about all the stuff going on. Most people have kind of calmed down by now and gone back to normal life, unfortunately a little too more normal.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's one of the problems. But yes, yeah, so we wanted to do this as a private deal so that we could bring most of our operations into the private sphere. And so the idea is that legally there is a difference between the public sphere and the private sphere. And the private sphere is like having someone over for dinner. If I have a friend over for dinner, I don't need the department of XYZ to come and inspect my fridge and make sure it's a certain temperature. And I don't need a license if I want to serve a glass of wine or whatever the case is.
Yeah.
It's a private deal.
Yeah.
And so the think of a private membership association as something that expands that out to a bigger group of members doing more things. And so we aren't open to the public. So therefore, we are not, in general, under those public regulations. However, like you said, that has been totally misused and blown out of proportion, and people think it's a magic bullet and you can do whatever you want. Some people do and do it successfully. However, many people do, and they go to court and they lose. So it's one of those things, take the risk if you want. You got someone like Amos Miller, who's been fighting court battles for, I don't know, a decade or so. And he did recently win one where the feds told him that he could sell his stuff. And he does this kind of thing where he says he's not under any public regulation. He does what he wants because it's members only. A judge recently said that he can sell his stuff within the states, all states in the U.S. as well as Canada. However, he still may not sell in his individual state because the state prosecutors there basically have it out for him. And so this is a giant organization. He's been dealing with this for 10 years. It's a big deal. And he still, even though the feds say, hey, yeah, you can legally do this, he's been having to deal with this, forking out all kinds of money, shut down multiple times. It's a pain. We'd rather not deal with that. And so the idea of having this a members-only organization from a, I guess, protection risk mitigation strategy is a layer, but that is not our ultimate layer, and I would not even say it's our top layer. It's just a layer of protection, kind of like operating as a service model, where we don't deal with the regulations of selling food because we just don't sell food. It's the same thing where we don't deal with a lot of the private or public regulations that a normal store would be under because we're just not in the public. We don't deal with public. And then on the other side, it also just makes a, I guess, more committed membership base where we want our model to be something where we're truly providing groceries for members that are like-minded, that we trust and they trust us. And we'd rather deal with a handful of members. Like our overall dream is to have 100 to 200 max members. That's it. But actually providing a high volume per member, and they're actually coming in nearly every week. And so in order to do that, we need some sort of commitment. They need to be committed to us. We need to be committed to them. And we found that this membership model, it weeds out a lot of people. So that can be a challenge. But it also ensures that the people you're dealing with are good and committed and easy to deal with. We don't deal with the general public, and we avoid the vast majority of the headache that comes with the general public. So that's something that's fit our model really well, and we found it to be super beneficial for us.
I think when you join something, you have like a vested interest in its success, where like if you're just a looky-loo that walks in off the street, you look for things to bitch about generally. Like that happens all the time. And it's amazing, the person that buys like five apples will tie you up with customer service BS for a week. And while you're dealing with that, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing for all your good customers. So I think putting that layer in there is not just a layer of protection. It's also a layer of ensuring service quality and customer quality. I think that we've got into this mindset in America where people are so worried about having, like, I love what you said about limiting your total, like having as many customers as possible. I don't want as many customers as possible. Customers are either good customers or they're problems. There's really not a lot of in the middle there. And I don't know if you're selling Chinese light bulbs or something, you probably don't really care. But if you're dealing some that's high contact, you want to filter out the problem customer before they're even there. Like a person that doesn't understand what they're doing with you, they're not going to become a member, so you're not going to have to deal with them. You know, they're going to actually, I think another thing when you do a membership, you kind of pay attention to what your requirements are, like, so that you understand the entity you're part of now. It's not even doing business with. You're now joining this and you're a piece of it. Like everybody has a little tiny ownership stake in this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we've noticed is in really big demand right now is that sense of community. It's really lacking. It's something that I know you've been talking about, the fourth turning cycles and all the historical cycles and patterns. It's one of the themes is that going back to more of a community centric thing. That is something that people have been really looking for. And you have that on a global scale when it comes to social media, but it's just an empty faux version of community. It's not real. It doesn't satisfy, and people are lacking in that area. And so especially folks that are like-minded and that feel that they're different from mainstream culture, they kind of feel isolated. They feel a little bit alone. They don't fit in with even their family and friends. And that's what we found. I found the same thing around when the time when COVID hit and started that that Freedom Cells group that morphed into, I guess, kind of what we're doing now. But it was just really amazing, and I did not expect it, that, hey, there are 12 people locally that live in my area that actually think the way I do. They actually are freedom-minded. They know what anarchism is without thinking it's bombs and riots in the streets.
And kids in black masks and jumping on top of cop cars and throwing paint on shit, right? Like,
Yes. Yeah. And so that's something that I was very pleasantly surprised to find that, and I bet just about everybody else that is listening, it's probably the same where you are, where no, you're not going to run into a lot of people like that on a very regular basis, and no, your friends and families, they're probably not like that either.
Yeah.
But there still are a lot of people out there, and there is that community, and it really means a lot to bring these people together, not only because, you know, all the benefits of having that mutual assistance kind of idea where you can help each other, you can share skills, you know, all the practical aspects, but it's also the emotional and relational aspects of belonging to something bigger than yourself, being a part of something that's truly good, making a difference in your community and in the world. These are things you can actually get when you're part of a community that is actively doing something. You're not getting that when you're on a Facebook group. And so that's something that's severely lacking in today's culture, that we feel like that's a niche that has really been really good for us, that a lot of our members are really looking for.
Well, and I would say that like the real world part of it actually is what makes that all gel. So, hey, Alabama right here is saying I have no like-minded family or neighbors that I know of. And I absolutely guarantee you do that. You do. You just don't know of them. You got that right. They're there. And so if I was in Chattanooga where you're at, we've had some people asking that. So he's in Chattanooga, Tennessee, folks. If I were there and I became a member of your thing and I show up for my weekly pickup and I'm there and I see this dude over here picking his stuff up, and I'm like, hey, man, my name's Jack. What's your name? He's Bill. I know right away Bill and I have a significant amount of ideology in common. right? And the fact that, and I could turn around and find out that Bill lives a block away from me, for all I know, right? And Bill and I might never, ever cross paths, right? And never even know each other, because we generally don't run around like, you know, going, hey, I'm an anarchist that believes in food sovereignty. If you're a libertarian and anarchist, I want to get to know. Like, we don't do that. When you create a common theme, the people that take part in that already have that component in common. So I see it as a great way not just to build a business and create these parallel systems, but to actually find the people near you who are like you. And I've seen how powerful that is. We do an event here, you know, Sunday morning, like 10:30, got to go. You got to leave. And there's like a group of people at the gate, and you almost have to like send one of the staff out there, because I can't be mean and go, Mr. Spirko would like you to leave now, right? And get, but I know what they're doing. They don't want it to go away. They spend their whole life, you know, in the office or whatever, surrounded by people they think they're weird. And then they finally realize, like, I'm not weird. There's a shitload of people just like me, and they don't want it to go away. So I see something like you're doing being a really good bridge for people like that to find each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we've tried to do from the get-go, is make this more of a hub than just a food club. So it's in our business structure as well as just in the practicalities. But the way we're set up is as actually a Christian ministry that's set up under the IRS tax code of 508C1A, which, again, when you look into PMAs, you're going to see that a lot. And okay, that's kind of like snake oil, where they say, hey, you can set yourself up as a church, and then you're automatically tax exempt. You don't have to file anything. And hey, we're all, you know, members of the universal church. And as long as you have faith in something,
yeah,
and you want to make a difference in the world, hey, you're the church and you can do this. Yes, you can, but it's not legal. The IRS specifically has a list of requirements for what they consider a church. And you can argue all day long whether they should or should not be able to determine that, but they do. And so that's not going to hold up in court. Mm-hmm. And there are countless PMAs that have been set up basically since COVID started under that structure, the 508C1A, that are basically just pipe dreams that just aren't going to hold up, unfortunately. So when we set up, we made sure that we went through that list and that we're actively and actually trying to set up in a way where we are structured that way. Because I am a Christian. That's something that I believe very wholeheartedly in. And I truly believe that according to the Bible, that we are supposed to be good stewards of creation. That's one of our purposes for humanity on this earth. We are to take care of the things God has put on this earth. We are to take care of each other, to love one another. We're not to put poison in our bodies, to poison the land, to mistreat animals. All of these things are totally in line with biblical principles, and some are explicitly said over and over again in the Bible. So if I cannot follow that when I go to the grocery store, which I cannot, neither can you.
Correct.
Then I got to do something else. And so there is no there's no just like backing out of it and being passive. There's no passively saying, oh, well, you know, I'm just not going to support the bad stuff. And, you know, I'm not actively going after the good stuff, but I'm also not actively going after the bad stuff. You know, I'm just a passive participant just going on about my world, and I'm focused on these other things. Well, that doesn't exist, because as individuals in modern society, where you put your money is what you are supporting. And that is an active thing. So when you go to Walmart and you buy crappy ground beef, you're actively supporting the farming practices that that farmer used to mass produce that super unhealthy ground beef that's giving you whatever diseases you're having. And that's just the way it is for absolutely everything. And so it's super unfortunate. That's not what I want for my world. And sometimes I have to do that as well. Sometimes I order random stuff off Amazon, or we still have to go to the grocery store every now and then for odd things here and there. But in general, we wanted to set something up where people could actively follow these biblical principles and live them out and spread that in our local community. And like you mentioned at the intro, yeah, the original church, the way it was set up was that they chose a parallel society approach, and they found themselves in a similar cultural situation we're in, where they didn't agree with Rome. They didn't agree with the culture. They didn't agree with the state. They didn't agree with hardly any of it, but they didn't try to fight it. They didn't try to participate in all the politics and change things or reform things. That just wasn't their thing. A lot of the early church fathers, they specifically said that a church member should not wear the purple or be a magistrate or go after that. Debatable as to whether or not they all believe that or not, and that's beyond the point. But a lot of them felt that way. And what they actively did was built a parallel society where they had their own court system, they educated their own kids, they had their own welfare system, and their welfare system was open to Roman citizens as well as the church. It wasn't exclusive. It was open to all, to the point that I read one letter from a Roman general that was complaining that the Roman state was looking bad because of these Christians, because they were taking better care of Roman citizens than Rome was. And so it was very effective, and that's the route that they chose to go with. And so that's what I've tried to model this after as well, where we're creating this community and a hub for these alternative systems, whether it's homeschooling, whether it's an alternative food system, legitimately doing things like Bible studies, and we've had some small groups and various things, education with classes and workshops and things like that, where we can truly create this hub for a parallel system. And that's what we really want to do. That's what's actually going to change things. And that's what's going to allow us as individuals to participate in a moral and effective way in society. But it just has to exist. And that's the thing, is in most places it doesn't exist. And so you just have these one-off barter situations and mutual assistance groups, and those are good. There's nothing wrong with them, but that's not touching the 99% of your budget. And if we want to do that, we've got to have something a little more structured.
So I think you were pretty clear on this. So I just want to make sure that everybody understands it. What you're saying is, since you've modeled that model, if somebody shows up and wants to become a member of your association for the food hub, and you say, well, we're a ministry as well, and they say, well, I'm an agnostic, I'm a Buddhist, I'm an atheist. That's not, it's not important that they join your church. They're joining your PMA that your church is part of. Is that accurate?
Yes. So the Agora is the hub as a whole. That is what's modeled as the Christian ministry, as the church. That's where we do, say, Bible study. We run classes through that. We do the bulk of our stuff as the Agora, which is open to anybody. And it's just basically, yes, it's a Christian ministry following biblical principles, trying to live that out and create a hub for that. The food club itself is the only thing that is set up for members only that you have to sign up for. And no, you do not have to be a member. You don't have to be religious. We have plenty of people that aren't. A vast majority actually are, but we're in the Bible Belt, and so that's just super common.
Sure.
But yeah, we are open to anybody, and we want to truly help our whole community. We don't want to just find random Christians here and there and make life good for them. Like, we want to truly improve things.
Well, I mean, I grew up Catholic, and sometimes we would run, like, things where we fed homeless or people struggling. And no one was like, hey, if you can't say a Hail Mary, you can't get a bowl of soup. Right. That's not very Christian. Right. To be like, we don't want you unless you pledge your allegiance to us. Like by leading by example, you lead people to where you're going. So and what you're describing, honestly, I can tell you a major religion that runs exactly this way today. And that's Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. They have their own welfare system, and you're welcome into it, even if you're not a Mormon. But they're going to put you to work, right? Like, they have their own, but they're like, you show up at a Mormon cannery and you're down on your luck, they'll start connecting you people you can interview for a job. They'll load you up with some food, but they'll set you off in the cannery and say, well, you work for a day, and then we're going to send you home enough food for a week or two. And so I think what's good about that is, if you end up in a legal test case, like, clearly these folks are a recognized religion, and we have a model very similar to what they're doing. And I think that is helpful, because how is this all viewed legally? Like I said, I think some people oversell the PMA. Once you have a PMA, everybody can get high on heroin, and it's okay, and there's nothing they can do about it. And, you know, you can have a monkey practicing medicine. Like, I'm going to the extreme, but I've heard it presented almost that bad, and you've already been clear. It doesn't quite work that way, but I do think there is some level of separation that you've created.
Right, right. And that's the thing, is that it's a layer. If you look at permaculture and stacking functions, that's what we're doing here. We're trying to have these layers where, you know, you have the guy from the state come in and say, hey, you're doing illegal activity. I am a public regulator for whatever it is. Like, oh, well, sorry, we're not open to the public, so, you know, see you later. And then if they press that and they come back, well, you're selling this illegal product. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, we don't sell anything.
Would you like to fill out a membership application? We'll determine whether or not you're allowed in.
Yes. And then if they, you know, they press that even further and they come back again, it's like, oh, well, according to our religious beliefs, which I can point out in the Bible, you've heard of that, haven't you?
Yeah.
It says that we are to be good stewards of the land. Here are the practices if we don't have this. So we just can't participate. So we have to do our own thing. So we have these multiple layers that stack. And there are ways, like another food club I know of in Kentucky, the way they're set up is more of a business structure-ish. But what they're called is a creature of contract. They've been to court over this before as well. And the way it's set up is you do have to sign a contract to join the food club. And then you are a member. But this was before PMAs were like a big thing. And so it is a members only thing. There is a membership fee. But then what they have is they actually have, I believe it's an LLC. They have a more formal business structure that basically runs all the finances for the food club. So the food club is just a loose association of members, and that's it. There's no formal structure. There's no formal person running it. There's no one to go after, which is another interesting thing for the state.
Decentralized.
Yes. And so they've got that. But then they do have a formal LLC that's basically holding the bank account. It's running the money for the accounts. It's paying suppliers. And that's a legit service that this LLC is providing. And so there are ways of setting this up in doing something that works well for you or your area that is not necessarily the way we set things up. And so it's very flexible, which is really nice. One of the things that another flexible option here is that for most people in your area, if you go to local farmers market, things are very expensive. And so, yes, the pros and cons to this. So on one side, you could take advantage of that. And if you have a fairly wealthy area and you're part of town or a big city nearby you, you set up a food club, you specialize in regenerative food that's actually healthy and basically all the stuff that we're doing, but you actually market that well, you make your place look nice and fancy, you can easily have farmers market prices or higher and get that and probably make a bunch of money. So that's wonderful. However, our model is different. What we want to do is actually provide a way for normal people to be able to afford groceries eating this kind of way, which was a huge challenge. But number one, because we think that's right. But number two, again, if you look at the pattern in society right now, we are due for an economic downturn at a very, very minimum. More than likely, we're going to have a crash of some kind. We're going to have a crisis period and things are going to happen. And so knowing that we're way overdue for that, even according to your Keynesians and everything, we're way overdue for at least a recession. When that happens, which it's almost guaranteed to happen, people cut discretionary spending. They just don't have as much money. That's just the way it is. And so if you've built your business off of people spending discretionary money on fancy things that they don't feel they actually need, what's going to happen when they don't have that? Well, you're going to lose a bunch of members and you're probably going to go under. And so we wanted to create something that not only was morally good in a sense that we're actually letting like single income homeschool families be able to truly afford groceries regeneratively, which is awesome, but also it protects us. It makes us more resilient in the future when things start to go downhill. Some of them might still have to drop off, but then we're probably going to get others that were going to Whole Foods and the farmer's market. They can't afford that anymore, but hey, they can actually afford us now. And we can actually provide groceries for folks even in a hard time scenario. So we just believe that was a wise way of approaching it. But again, there's lots of ways you could do this, and either one would be just as viable as the other.
Do you have any supply chain issues? Like one of the things that I've thought about trying to do something like this, or maybe sponsor someone into doing, because I have my other thing to do here locally. And, you know, there's just not a massive amount of locally produced food in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. It is a harsh climate. Our best time to produce food is really from about right now until it freezes. It's better than spring. It's way better than summer. So it's very seasonal in our production. People want things that don't grow where you are, like an orange or a banana. Do you just not do that stuff, or do you have some way that you source it? Like, how do you make sure that there's enough variety and quantity to be able to serve your members?
So the way we have adapted to approach this is that, number one, we have some Amish and Mennonite communities close by, and they grow a lot of stuff. However, it is a myth that they are all organic and all natural. Most of them are totally conventional. So like we actively had to like knock on doors and find the organic farmers, and it was a bit of a pain. But we have some suppliers that come from those communities, which is really nice. We also have been really big on promoting member suppliers, which is super helpful, kind of with what you're talking about, where we might not be able to find a regenerative farm that makes all these different products we need. But in this community of like-minded members, they're all pretty much doing something. And so, like, we've got one guy that roasts coffee. We have a lady that makes granola. We have someone that makes milk kefir. We have multiple bakers. We have people that make all these different things, an herbalist, a homeopath, all these things. And so we can compile that together, and at our scale, we can actually make that work without a problem. I mean, we don't need, like, you know, 20 gallons of granola every single week to service 1,000 people coming in and out, because we're just not at that scale, and we don't want to be. So if we can stick at this smaller scale, we can source from smaller people. They can keep prices down, because a lot of times they're doing it more as a hobby than anything else, and they want to help the community. Yeah. But it's kind of a side gig, and they're truly making money, so that's great. But then also, as far as like the seasonality goes, to an extent, there are things like produce that we just don't have all the time. So in the wintertime, we're not going to have a lot of the stuff that we have in the summer. And even things like meat. We do rounds of, say, whole chickens. And when we're going to do a round, we let people know. They can order ahead of time, get them fresh. We get extra. We have a big freezer. So we have whole birds that are frozen that usually last for a while. But if we run out of that, we run out of that. And you're going to have to wait till the next batch. We do offer things like, say, half cow, quarter cow, whole hog, whole chickens, you know, all these kinds of things. So if you want, you just get in on that early. You stock up. We promote that. And then you have it. We try to do the same for the food club. We try to keep the stuff we feel people really want and need. We also do some bulk orders. So we have Frontier Co-op is a group that we use, and Azure Standard. We use them for some stuff. We even go to Costco. So that's a good example where, you know, in general, I'd rather not get anything from Costco. However, it's a great place to go for some of these organic things, where I can get the Costco peanut butter organic for about half the price as if I were to go straight to the manufacturer and get a whole pallet shipped to us. It's still going to be cheaper at Costco. And it's ridiculous. But that's the way it is. And so we do that for a handful of items. And then if members want something and they ask us for it, you know, if it's a one-off thing even, often we can just pick that up while we're there. And so things like apples and bananas and citrus, things that we just don't have around here, or they're super seasonal but people always want them, we do try to keep those staples in stock at all times as best we can. Yeah. And something like that's the way we do it. If you wanted to use a food distributor, that could work very well, but we just personally don't want to do that.
No, and I get it too. And somebody might be out there thinking right now, if I can get it at Costco, why am I going to buy it out of this co-op? Because you get all the other stuff out of the co-op, and you don't have to go to Costco. I go to Costco more than I want to, because I don't ever want to go. I don't like Costco. Now, if I was going there as part of my business, from a standpoint of like a supply run, that might feel a little bit different. And you also then get to go to Costco at like Tuesday at 11 a.m. Instead of when most people have to go to Costco in the middle of their Saturday, right? Like, Costco is not the kind of place you stop by on the way home from work, unless it's across the street from where you work. It's so like that conglomeration. And I do think that gives more diversity and depth of product, and that's really useful. I was working with some people here as a supplier from our duck eggs when we were much larger that were doing exactly that kind of model. Now, whether they were doing it in the same legal framework, I don't know. I didn't work with them for very long because we were already scaling back at that point. But they basically told us, we have enough members that want duck eggs. We'll take all you have. All we need is on Monday, I want an estimate of how many I can pick up on Friday so that I know how many to take orders for. That's all they needed to know is how many will you have for us about 4 or 5 days in advance. They wanted that number. And that was easy to do. And also we had like a clearinghouse, like anything we weren't selling to a restaurant or to direct retail, we just had a place to just, and that made, had we stayed in that business, it would have made that a lot more stable for us, because what would happen is we'd get a restaurant, they would love the product and they're like, we want 80 dozen a month. Okay, that's going to take us 6 months to ramp up to that level of production, add some more birds, do some more hatching, cull some drakes. And you'd get up there, and then they'd run for like 6 months, and they're like, well, we think your product's a little bit too expensive. We're going to take it off the menu. Okay, wait a minute. For a year, you bought 80 dozen eggs a month, and you cried you couldn't get more. And now you think it's too – you could have just added a dollar to the dish you were sticking it on. And I guarantee you the kind of restaurant this was, not a single person would complain. So we, you know, we'd lose places like that, and it would inevitably would happen is they'd come back to you about 3 months later. And well, I'm sorry, but having someone that has that multiple customer distribution, I think you'd stay a lot more stable there.
Yeah, brings up a good point. You're asking about suppliers earlier, and kind of your story is something we've ran across many times where we've had suppliers, like one guy in particular, when he first started, he was selling whole chickens at a local market, farmer's market. And so we started getting some whole birds from him. And then he was like, hey, you know, I'm going to try making this this chicken sausage roll. And so he blends it up with some seasonings. He bakes it. It's like a summer sausage made with chicken. And it was good. And I was like, well, what about hot dogs? You know, we could use some hot dogs. And so using a natural seasoning blend, he started making hot dogs. And then he raised some pigs for us and started doing eggs for us. And, you know, again, ramped up, scaled up. But the only reason he did that was because we were a steady customer for him, and he could count on that. We worked well together, and we were able to get some of these very small-scale people up to a point where they can supply the food club, and they're supplying us. So we win, they win, and it's this direct relationship where if there's something like, for example, the chicken roll, we started questioning the ingredients in the natural seasoning that he was using, which was pretty good. But it wasn't perfect. And so we started making our own seasoning blend at the food club. We take that to him, and now that's what we use when we make sausage or hot dogs or anything else. We just make our own spices out of organic seasonings, and that's it. Take it to him. They mix it in. And so we've built this relationship where, if there's something that a member wants that's kind of custom, we can often do it. If there's an issue, again, having members, not general public, they will let us know what the issue is, and maybe they're not happy about it, but they're not whining about it. They're not complaining. They're not throwing a fit. They're just letting us know. They're totally understanding. We can work through it. We talk to the suppliers who we know we're directly connected with. And again, this all works out really, really well on just about every level. And a lot of that is having that direct connection with the suppliers themselves. They're scaling up while we are scaling up. We're doing this together. And again, it's that sense of community where all this is staying together in this sphere. And like even the member suppliers, say someone brings in, let's say, some granola, and then another member picks up that granola this week. So the granola maker's account gets credited for X amount. Then they use that amount to get something from another member. Okay. And so it's a glorified barter system, and that money just circles around. But it's done in a way that's actually efficient, and you don't have to deal with the coincidence of needs and that kind of stuff. But it's also outside the system. It's also supporting everybody. It's also allowing people to scale up who want to. It's just, it does all of these things all at once in a very synergistic way that it just makes a lot of sense.
Well, it makes barter doable because the problem with barter is why we invented money, because, you know, I have duck eggs and you have cheese and I don't need cheese and you don't need duck eggs.
Yep.
Right. So we have an issue there where, or maybe you need duck eggs, but I don't need cheese. Or I need cheese, but you don't need duck's eggs. So, like, if you have enough diversity of that, you get some barter working there, and that's great. And when it doesn't work, then money can still fill the need. You mentioned a little bit on what you guys do about government regulations, but can you talk about, like, does this get you out of any of the regulations, and are there some that you wouldn't want to comply with, but you still have to?
In general, this gets us out of just about all of the regulations the way we are set up. I would say that we're a relatively unique scenario, that we are a legit 508c1a, which is not super common. So most people would have to pick and choose which ones they want to go by and which ones they don't. But yes, in general, because since we're offering a service, we're not selling anything. Mm-hmm. We don't deal with any of the sale of food regulations. Since we're not open to the public, in theory, we don't have to abide by any regulation, but I don't trust that anyway.
Like I said, if y'all were cooking heroin, there'd be a problem, right?
There would be.
There's also regulations of legal goods, and then there's things that are outside the law. So in no way are eggs an illegal product, but you can handle eggs in a way that the handling is illegal, but the egg itself isn't illegal. Or gray market, right? Versus black market on the Agora's flag. But there are things that are illegal outright that would be fully into the black market. And I don't think any legal structure except maybe a ship outside international waters gets you past that. And not that doesn't even work for everything.
Right. And a lot of this has to do with how we set things up. So I can give you two examples that we don't currently have, but we've talked about before. And that would be making food. So say a small scale restaurant or pre-made meals and alcohol. Okay. So those are two things that are super highly regulated.
Yep.
We don't want to mess with that, at least from a regulatory standpoint. However, think about, like, what if we wanted to open up a small-scale cafe? Well, what we could do is we have all these ingredients at the food club that are owned by members already.
Okay. Again,
we're not selling anything. They already own them. So what if those members want to pitch in together and pay someone for the service of converting those ingredients into a meal? Well, they can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. That's, again, a totally private thing that they are doing, not highly regulated at all. And so someone could come in, basically offer the services of a private chef, take those ingredients in the food club for the benefit of the members, turn it into a product that they want to eat. And say we have once a week, it's Wednesday nights, and you have a date night or whatever you want. You sign up ahead of time. We have someone come in there cooking meals, providing that for members, and we run a small scale cafe that way. Or maybe it's lunch every day, or whatever we wanted to do. But we could do that in a way where we're not actually making meals and selling them, but instead there's a service being provided. And again, depending on how you set up, how that person cooking it gets paid or reimbursed, you could even set that up in an even more friendly way with even less regulatory issues whatsoever with income, that kind of stuff. So that's an example. The other one would be alcohol. We've talked about making mead. And that's something we've made before and tried out, and it's really good. We think it'd be great. It's honey-based, which we do a lot of honey products. And so what we've talked about doing, and we might end up doing, is having a mead club. Or maybe it's a brewing club as a whole, and you branch out. But with a mead club, if someone is interested in mead, whether it's drinking it or making it, or ideally both, they sign up for the mead club. So we have these members. All the members chip in, and what they're chipping in for is the ingredients and paying the cost of, say, a class to learn how to make mead. And then every time we do each step, we invite members to come in. They learn how to make it. They learn the whole process of making mead. Each time we do something, they're welcome to come in or not. It's up to them. They already paid for all the ingredients. So again, it's not buying and selling. We just chipped in, bought everything ourselves. And then in the end, when it's ready to bottle, we have a bottling day. All the members come in and then we divvy it up according to, I guess, kind of a share for how much everybody pitched in at the beginning. And so, again, we're not selling anything. We're just distributing this thing that we've done together. It's more of a class-based model. You could add a service fee in there for, say, I'm the one leading it, and I'm the one doing most of the work. I'm the one with the knowledge. Maybe I charge a $20 an hour fee.
You're the one watching over it ferment for, you know, 6 months or whatever. Yeah.
Right. And so you can work in whatever you want in that model, but it's still a model where there is no ATF. And that's a really big deal because they're a really big deal.
Put communion wine on the label, right?
You could. We try to stick to actual legitimate use.
Yeah, I got you. And the first thing that went in my head is communion weed.
Well, that is something that, like, people do run into this issue a lot. I don't even think it's played out to its full extent that it will. But a lot of people set things up. Think of a herd share. So a herd share is a way that in most states you can legally sell raw milk.
Correct.
Because what you're doing is you are buying a share of a herd of cows, which is perfectly legal. And then you're due the proceeds from that herd of cows. So say it's a gallon of milk.
My cow, hence it's already my milk. I paid somebody to milk the cow.
Right. And so that's perfectly legal in our state. That's the most common one used. It's the least amount of hoops you got to jump through. And the food club, again, stacking protections, we have a herd share contract with multiple dairies. And so not only are we private, not only do we not sell the raw milk, we also have a herd share. Like, you stack that. But the point is that it is perfectly legal to deal with raw milk in that way through a herd share. However, it is a very gray, if not black, area for the dairy producer to then say, would you like a pound of butter for $15?
Okay.
Because obviously, I am not getting a percentage of what that herd produced. I'm just buying a one-off item, that butter, or the cream, or the yogurt, or whatever the value-add product is, which is illegal. However, that's how 99% of dairies operate. And, you know, in a way, that is black market, because they are not divvying out those value-add products according to the share that people own in that herd share. So for me personally, I don't want to participate in a model like that. However, most people do, and most people don't get busted, and for whatever reason, the state doesn't care, and so it works. But there's a lot of things like that. Same with PMAs, where according to, say, the Constitution and case law, the government has no right to come in between a contract between two individual citizens unless there is substantive evil, I believe is the phrase, that's occurring. And that has been defined in case law as basically like killing or torturing somebody.
Okay.
So that's a perfectly good legal precedent to say, hey, I do what I want because I'm involved in this contract. Government has no right to get in the way. However, we live in a real world that's corrupt and doesn't work that way. So I don't put much faith in things like the Constitution and case law. So again, it's this idea where there's lots of ways where you can get around the law. There's lots of hoops you can jump through. There's lots of, you know, state jujitsu you can do.
Yeah.
We prefer to be able to be in a position where if I get called into court and I'm standing before a judge, I can state my case and it actually sounds legit. And it's not that, oh, I sideskirted the law.
Let me refer you to Mayberry versus Madison in the year 1888. Like that. No, right. Judge is like, out, done, it's over. Like that looks good on TV shows, but it doesn't work.
Right, right. And so we want to set up in a way where I can in a real way, where I truly mean it, say that I am trying to live out biblical principles according to XYZ. We are set up in this way. And this is what we're doing. Not that I have this mission according to this random faith that I have, and I'm just trying to do good for the community. Well, what do you do? When do you meet? What books do you go by? What's your doctrine?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. You know, whatever feels good. Like, that's not going to work.
Well, and even if it does work, it's not legit. Stay out of court, not to win in court, because what good is it if you're running a business that makes you $100,000 a year, you get taken to court, and you win, but it costs you $1 million?
Right. Yeah,
right.
That's
not sustainable.
We have an example of that locally where there was another person that started a similar model as us in Chattanooga a few years ago. I don't know how many. It might have been 5 to 10 years ago. And it was this thing where they were sourcing local high-quality food from various farms. They were bringing it in one place. They had drivers and they had a whole delivery service. And this
that's
was like right
with
the pandemic.
They delivered, right? Yeah.
Yes. And so they were doing this whole thing, and it was set up as a PMA, again, before PMAs were much of a thing, and it was legit, and it was legal. However, they got taken to court, and it was by, I think, like 4 different government agencies took them to court over separate issues, and they never lost in court, but the lady who was running it was in the middle of a lot of personal stuff. She had multiple kids. She was adopting a kid from overseas at the times. There's all this stuff going on. Probably money's a factor. And even though she knew all the case law, she was perfectly within her rights legally and constitutionally. She probably could have fought it out. She ended up having to drop it and just shut the thing down and not do it. And so it's one of those things where, yes, it's legal. Yes, technically they can't touch you. But there are lots of things they can do that are going to make it not work for you, and it's not worth it. So, yes, as much as possible, if we can stack all these layers of protection and not even go to court because they come and, take me to your leader. We don't have a leader. Sorry. You're selling this and that's illegal. Oh, we don't sell anything.
We don't sell anything.
And so, yeah, it's just whatever they ask. It's like, well, I'm sorry we're not under that. So see you later. And ideally, yes, we just stay out.
God, God's in charge. If you want to talk to him, there's a free one-way phone line open at all times. You feel free to talk to God. And
that's right.
If you get an answer from him that differs from us, trust him.
Yes, yes.
That sounds like a very frustrating answer to a bureaucrat.
Yeah, that's kind of how we've tried to start this thing from the get-go, is how can we set this up in a way that's legitimate but is also outside of the system, which is super hard.
Yeah.
And it is resilient in a lot of ways. So supply chain shut down. All of our food that we get, or the vast majority of our food, is within 45 minutes of a physical drive from our food club.
Okay.
And so we can drive and pick up the stuff. So I don't care if the semis aren't running. I don't care if a hurricane hits. It doesn't matter because I can still drive, go to the farm. The cows are still there. They're still producing milk. Chickens are still there to be slaughtered. It's all still there. So we can still get it. We bring it in. We are insulated from a lot of those things. We have a price structure that's set up in a way where, you know, even if times get hard, people can still actually afford it. And let's say there's vax mandates, or you have to have a digital ID to get into a grocery store, you know, whatever the thing is that comes up next, we don't have to deal with that.
Yeah.
And we've set ourselves up in this way where we're super resilient from all these different angles. And we've created this hub and community where most of the times when places like this, or even just regenerative farmers that get busted for, say, selling raw milk, whatever it is, when they go to court, oftentimes one of the biggest differences is, does a community show up to that courthouse? And when the community does, whether it's at the physical location when the agent is there, or in court in front of a judge, almost always it gets dismissed because they don't want to deal with that. That's bad PR. Imagine that.
When Queenie Benini shows up from the local news service to interview 45 members who can't buy their food anymore, that doesn't look like embarrassment is one of the few tools we have against bureaucrats. Like, they really don't like the light on them. They like to feel powerful. They like to shut things down, but they don't like to be accountable because other than in that situation, they're seldom accountable to anybody or for anything. Right. I listened to Joel Salatin talk about how he's had his entire business operations at times jacked up, not because any law changed, because the bureaucrat changed. So one guy retires, a new guy comes in and starts kicking things over and, you know, red tagging meat at the processor, which he eventually got through that. But the fact that you even had to tells you what you're risking. And I mean, you got to think about this one. Let's say I don't like Joshua and I'm going to sue you for whatever reason in court. Well, I have to pay for it all, and if I lose, I'm screwed. If I'm a government alphabet agency and I want to take you to court, it doesn't cost me shit, right?
Yeah.
The taxpayer pays for it. The resources are almost unlimited that they have, and I do believe that they conduct themselves in ways that if private companies did, they would go under the jail. When you said that one group was attacked by four different agencies, do not tell me for a minute and insult my intelligence that those agencies were not coordinating with each other when they did that. I know they were. And if you do that as a private company, it's like price fixing, it's racketeering. They'll come up with some shit and they will come after your ass. They'll come after you under RICO if they have to, even though it's not what it's supposed to be for. But when a government does it, it's completely acceptable. Right. It's like when back right before the last election, when all of the social media platforms colluded and banned all the same people within a couple of days of each other. Right. Like, and they should have got away with that, but they're big enough that they did. But if you and me were running a couple small local businesses and we started colluding those businesses together, they'll put us under the daggone jail. And so I think like picking and choosing your battles is what I'm hearing you say. And that's really a great way to go. In all this, if we're going to be sustainable, not just from an agricultural standpoint, but with the true meaning of sustainable and continue to keep going, you got to make some money. Can you do well enough with profit to make this a going concern, especially if it's like the only thing you want to do?
So, yeah, money's always the big thing. I did write down some figures just to give an idea, and I'll explain our price structure because we've done this two different ways. So the first way, and probably the way most people would do it, is that we attached a service fee to every item we provided. And we tried to make that legit. You know, if we have to drive for an hour to pick up milk, you know, that's going to be a higher service fee than if a member makes something and just drops it off. But it was, you know, say average 30% on things, and that's our service fee for getting it, bringing it to the food club, keeping it there, whatever. And so we did it that way. And then it was a really cheap, I think it was $5 a month was the membership fee. And that worked, but we wanted to get, again, a higher commitment out of people, lower number of members, but higher volume, more commitment. And we switched probably 6 months ago or so to a model where we flipped that around. And now to be a member, you're paying $20 a week, which seems very high. Yes. But in exchange, you get all the stuff at our cost. So, we factor in things like gas and ice, you know, in a sense, like shipping costs, so to say. Like, what does it cost for us?
You're figuring out your true COGS, your cost of goods sold. You don't mean that I went down to Bill's Dairy and I got, you know, this much of whatever for X. You mean what was the total cost to get that product to the customer?
Correct. Which in general is the price we pay for it plus 15%. That ended up being the average. And so that covers our coolers, our ice, our gas, our time to like sort stuff after we have to sort it. But it's not our overall time. It's not our utilities. It's not a salary. It's nothing else. It's just the cost to get those goods and get them in the food club and keep them there. And so doing so, there are local dairies that sell gallons of raw milk for twice as much as a member can pick it up for through the food club. And so we've gotten our prices very low, where members can, again, truly afford their groceries. But, you know, the catch is you're paying $20 a week no matter what. And so the way we figured it up is that we can pay the bills to run the food club and cover those costs at $20 per member per week. And then everything else, you know, we pass along the savings to the member. So if a member gets $300 worth of stuff, their first roughly $50 worth of stuff covers the cost of their membership. They're going to save enough when they spend, say, $50 or maybe even $75, depending on the items. They're going to save enough to cover their weekly membership already. And then if they get anything over that, they're basically just getting food at a drastic discount as much as they want. So if you've got a family and they're getting $300 a week worth of food, that's a lot of savings where they can truly afford stuff, and it doesn't hurt us at all. So even though we're dealing with a greater volume, it's a greater volume but still a low number of members. And like you said, that's a lot less work and issues where I'm dealing with one family with $300 worth of stuff instead of, you know, 10 different families with $30 worth of stuff. It's a lot easier. And so if you were to set up stuff that way, and I just went over some rough numbers here. So if you had it that way and you had 50 members doing that membership plan and they averaged $100 per pickup, and let's say only 40 of those members come in and even get any given week, someone's on vacation, you know, different stuff. That's still going to total up to $1,600 a week, which if you multiply it out differently, because there's 52 weeks in a year, that would be basically $6,933 a month. And so, you know, you could look at that.
That's $1,040 a year per customer, assuming they stay for a full year. That's what it comes out to. So each customer has a profit, I guess would be the way to look at it, a value to the business. Right.
Yes. And so,
if you want 50,000 a year, you need 50 customers.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets tricky depending on how you set it up. Like the word we're set up, we don't use words like profit and sales selling and business, but yes. It basically boils down to, if you had those numbers, which we've done it and that's manageable numbers, that's $7,000 a month. Now you figure out for yourself, does $7,000 a month make sense for you to pay utilities, to get a space to do this at, to run things, to pay yourself, you know, whatever, however you want to spend that money, is that enough money? If not, do you want a set of 50 members? What if you had 100 members or 150 members? Mm-hmm. And then keep in mind, you might need multiple partners to then run something like this. But those numbers, for most people, scale that to where you want it, but that can make sense and be a legit job where you can easily make, say, $60,000 a year working roughly full-time hours. So you might not get rich, but you can live pretty well. And at the same time, you're probably getting really cheap food, which then cuts down on your grocery bills. So your bills are a lot lower. So yes, it's financially viable for people. The other thing to consider is if you did it similar to the way we do, but again, lots of other ideas you can incorporate. But like for us, we don't have just the food club. We also have classes that we run. We also might have some in-house products. So say you had a commercial style kitchen and you're making your own elderberry syrup, your own pre-made meals. Your costs are much lower. You have, you know, a higher margin on those goods versus the ones you bring in. That's more money. We have gardens. We have some fruit trees. We have things like that. And that's all aside from labor.
Outlet for your own production.
Outlet for own production, yes. And so ideally, you can stack all these things together where you're growing your own food on site. You're having classes on how to prune fruit trees, how to garden organically. You have volunteers that are part of your community that are coming and helping with the labor. You have a kitchen where you're converting that into value-add products. You have your mainstay core grocery stuff, bringing these people in every week. So you have that big market of committed people. And then not only are they getting their groceries, but you start making value add, you start making desserts, you start making meals, you're basically upselling to this community you already have. So if they're going to spend the money already at, say, a restaurant or a pre-made meal service or somewhere else, why not have them spend it with you? They would rather spend it with you and support what you're doing. And so instead of having to up your membership by 20 new members, what if you just up the volume per member, because now you're making pre-made meals and you're sourcing those ingredients, you know, 80% you're growing in the yard yourself. And again, you're stacking all these things together. And while you're doing this in the kitchen, you're teaching a class on how do you make bone broth? How do you make sauerkraut? How do you make mead? How do you do these things? And, you know, you structure that how you want. But if you charge money for those things, then not only are you making the, you know, say roughly $7,000 a month with 50 members, you're also making money for all those things. And if you can rent out your space, then that can bring in more money. If you have other people come in and teach classes and you take a cut, that's bringing in more money.
Sure,
Sure. So depending on how you do that, there's a lot of opportunity to stack. And then the one thing, like for me, this is a huge deal, like having that built-in market. So at our personal property, we have hogs. And so we raise pigs. We're creating like a silvopasture system. They're a unique breed of pigs, the Meishan. They're really cool. But the point is, we raise pigs. And so we have pork. And I would like an outlet for that pork. And if I can guarantee that I can move X amount of hogs twice a year, then that's wonderful. I don't have to do the marketing. I don't have to drive anywhere special. I don't have to deal with the regulation. I can just do what I want, and I've got the market built in, and that's done. And the same is true for a lot of our members, where, you know, if they want to get in these niche markets and charge farmers market prices, they go to the farmers market and they do that. But then often they also drop some stuff off with us, give us a huge discount, and our members can get it at a relatively cheap price, and everything works. So having that core built-in market then leads into all these other opportunities where, yeah, you can stack these different enterprises and fit that to what makes sense to you. So yes, I would say for anybody, this is very financially viable, but you want a customized structure to fit that to what makes sense in your area and what makes sense for you personally.
Yeah, and I think also, like, one of the things about this is the geographic independency. I mean, you're probably not going to set one of these up if you own 100 acres in the middle of the Arizona desert and your closest neighbor can't be seen without climbing up a pole. However, you don't need a huge population center. You need enough people to be members and enough producers to do this. So if you tell somebody, you know, after you pay all the bills and all, you can, you know, and your taxes and everything, you can clear $60,000 a year here in Dallas-Fort Worth, okay. But, I mean, there's a lot of W-2 jobs you can make that kind of money on. If you're in a lot of these smaller towns and places where people wait to eventually get a job working at a Walmart, right, because there are places like that. Like, you can tell a lot about of an economy is look at the people in the Walmart. When you go into a Walmart and you're like, these are all, like, young to middle-aged people that look clean-cut and they look like they really know what's going on, and I could probably take this person right out of here and put them in a business environment and they could do that job if it was available. You're in a place with an economy like I'm talking about. When you go in, you say, it's a good thing Walmart exists or this person wouldn't have a job. Well, then you're in more like this economy. And so, like, that kind of sweet spot in the middle, I don't really know a lot about Chattanooga, but I kind of get the feeling that it's more that size of a town, right? Like, it's a city, but it's not Atlanta. It's not Jacksonville. It's not LA, right? It's not like a place where people are start at Chick-fil-A for $25 an hour or something. Cause there's literally places where that's going on. Now here, I think Chick-fil-A starts teenagers at $18.
Oh,
right. I mean, it's kind of nuts, but that's what they have to pay to get the best of that group to come work for them, because they want to be better than McDonald's. That's all they're trying to do, be better than McDonald's, Burger King, and Taco Bell. So the Taco Bell's throwing 14 to 16 an hour for part-time employees. But a lot of these towns, like, grown-ass men are lucky to make that money. And so then your cost of living goes down, plus, like you said, you're getting the cheap food. So I think the strategic location, the other side would be if you set it up here, I bet those numbers could be better. Because we have a lot more concerned Karens in our market. You might be able to pick up 50 customers in two suburbs, right? Not even suburbs. What do you call it? Subdivisions. And I better turn that off. I got. I'm going to tell anybody what just happened. We had that on yesterday for playing around with John and Nicole. And if you're on the audio, you have no idea what just happened. Anyway, but you see what I'm saying? Like, you can, like, the people that were doing it that I was working with here as a supplier, you know, I think they had primarily kind of an upper level customer. So I think it's very adaptable is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Even where we are in Chattanooga, if we were in downtown Chattanooga, there is a lot more money.
Yeah.
And a lot more people that shop at Whole Foods all the time for all their groceries. Whereas the suburb that we are in, say 20 minutes outside of Chattanooga, not many people are going to Whole Foods or want to spend that kind of money. And
they
then
don't
you go,
have it, or they just don't want to go there and deal with all the yuppie foodies, right?
Right. And so, yes, even where we are, if we wanted to have the food club in Chattanooga, then instead of, say, $70,000 a year, you might make $100,000 a year. And then if we wanted to go in the outskirts a little further and say we lived out in the boondocks and didn't want to drive all the way for an hour, we could probably set something up and make $50,000 a year. But again, like you say, cost of living, is probably going to even out depending on where you're living and how close you are.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's very adaptable. And then also, like, we, in a sense, we leveled out the playing fields on our own free will by not charging farmers market prices. So we could do that and we could make more money that way. I just personally don't really have a lot of confidence in things continuing the way it is for very long. So I would prefer to be more resilient and have that risk mitigation strategy in place, but not make as much money, than to make more money and then fail if things crumble. So,
well, and if you're able to sell people product at that price, then they're a lot more stable in your customer base, right? So,
sure.
Like, as eventually, if you hit kind of your limit where you say we're not taking new members and you have a waiting list, well, then nobody wants to leave, right? It's like, well, mm-hmm. I really, you know, I think I need to step away from a few months. Well, that's okay. But you should know we have a waiting list of 80 people, and if you step out, you go to the back of the line.
Right.
Right, you know. And at some point, maybe you start charging new members a little bit more, and if you go out and you come back in, you pay the new price, right? Like, I mean, marketing is not something we should ignore, and marketing is not just about attracting attention. It's also about retention. Mm-hmm. And I think there's, long-term, there's – because I know certain, like, there's a gun club I want to join. I need about 40 more people to die, right? It's never going to happen, right? Like, and it's just not going to happen unless some member wants to sell their membership and comes to me directly. Like, I'm not getting in. And I think that, like, you don't have to be really expensive to have some level of exclusivity. And it seems like that's long term where you might be headed.
Yeah. Yeah. We do plan on when we hit a certain volume, and we cannot handle that volume anymore or much more than that, we're going to cap membership. And that's exactly what we'll do. In theory, we could expand. We could bring on new partners. We could have a remote startup, a second location, and help someone else get off the ground. I actually went and talked to a group in a town that's 2 hours from here, and they're looking at starting up a food club. So if they do, I'll probably consult with them and help them get that off the ground, and that would be great. But also, we've talked about doing deliveries, where the way we do it, because, you know, personally, I don't have the time. What we would do is we'd find a member that lives in XYZ town that's 30 minutes away. And we have a lot of people that are on that side of town and they just don't want to deal with the traffic to get over, whatever the case is. Well, what if that member basically acts as a delivery driver,
mm-hmm.
and everyone in that area places orders online? We fulfill those orders, put them in boxes. That person comes and picks it up. And even if we don't make a dollar off of it, that person can charge $10 a person or 10% or whatever it is they want to do. And then they bring all that stuff back. They handle that meetup distribution. Everybody gets their box and they're done. And then all of a sudden we can handle 20 more members in a part of town where they wouldn't have been coming in. We wouldn't have had them anyway. And that's a very viable option too. And then we don't have to deal with delivery and all the costs of that. So win-win for us. Again, there's a lot of options here and it's super flexible, which also makes it super adaptable, which, yeah, works really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember Joel Salton talking about, like, these two old ladies used to come in and they would load up like three giant igloo coolers and he had to get a couple of his guys to put them back in the truck for him because they couldn't lift them. And that's what they were doing. They were driving down to his place and going back up. And basically they were a Karen courier, right? They were bringing all the food to the concerned Karens. And he's like, that's fine. I don't mind. And I've sold it. It's gone, right? That's a good thing.
Right.
But on that, we've had a couple people asking about shipping, and what you're describing is still very localized. I don't mm-hmm. think this model works for you to deliver food to a person in Jacksonville, Florida, or at Los Angeles, California, because I think that kind of actually goes against what you're trying to do. Like, it's a ministry, and then, like, you're trying to become a televangelist instead of a local church, like, a way to compare it. And you're talking about fresh food that doesn't necessarily ship that well. That's kind of the problem with you. Like, they're growing a certain variety of tomato, not because it's really good or tastes really good, because it doesn't crack and you can ship it, and it can sit in a truck for a week and still look good, even though it tastes like cardboard. And so you're trying to do the exact opposite of that. So it's a very localized thing. And I think what people should be looking for is there something like this in their area? And if not, can they put together a consortium or find somebody they know would be right for this and turn them onto it and build one locally?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. There's actually a guy I talked to about a year ago, and he had a small food club, and he was just doing this on the side. It was like a once-a-month pickup. There were maybe 10 families, super small. But again, anybody could do that, just on the side, even working full-time. But he was looking at doing an online version that was a shipping across country deal. If we wanted to, and you're right, we don't want to, and that's not our mission, not our thing. But if we wanted to, or someone like us wanted to, you could incorporate that. And it's definitely possible to ship frozen meats.
Yeah.
Amos Miller is a good example of one that ships all across the country with custom slaughter stuff under a PMA structure. There is precedent for it. It's doable, but it is a different model. And yeah, kind of, I think you're probably along the same track as me, where what I want to do is it's not just to have this successful thing where I can make it work. I also want to create something that's resilient and sustainable and will hold a community together, you know, when times get hard, or even if they don't. It's that kind of thing I want to be there and set something up that's going to work well for us. We're physically here together. We're building true community and true resilience. I can drive to the suppliers. I see their farms. I can get that meat. I can get that milk, whatever it is. Get it to the food club. Get it to the members. We know each other. Like, to me, that's what we're building. And yes, you could do something that's remote and virtual and all that stuff, just like you can build, you know, say your TSP community. You know, you've got a community and it's online and it's great and there's good things about it, but it's different than when people come in person. And so they're just two different things. It's not that one is necessarily better than the other and the other one just shouldn't exist. It's just they're different. And so you got to choose what works best for you and what you're really trying to do.
Well, and I think people understand we're giving them a way, not the way, to get into this market or to participate in this market. I can't remember who it is now. It's not Gabe Brown, but it's somebody kind of tied in with his whole group. But I think Gabe's out in the Dakotas or something like that. And this guy's either in like Ohio or Indiana or something. And he's an older farmer and he's got all these farmers around him. And it's like a 3 or 4 hour, wherever he is, it's like 3 or 4 hour drive to Chicago. And so what he's done is he's hooked up all these local farmers and built a catalog. And he goes once a week to Chicago, and all the customers are restaurants. And because of this model, some of these farmers that have, you know, 1,100 acres or 2,500 acres or whatever, their kids want to farm. And that farm doesn't produce enough money growing corn and beans for that kid to have a place until dad retires and sells the kid the farm, puts the kid in debt. But the farmer say to the kid, well, here's an acre that we're not doing anything really with anyway. You can have this. And some of these kids, by the time they're out of high school, are making more money off an acre than their dad's making off 1,000. And like he said, I was listening to him, it was on John Kemp's podcast a few months ago. He was saying they got this one chef that only wants these one cherry tomatoes that this one kid grows. And he doesn't even care how much they cost. He's like, I put 4 on a salad, but they have to be there cut in half and they have to look like this. And he gets upset, like, I can't get them in December. No, you can't get them in December, right? But he spun that into, like, this is only available on my menu in these times. So that's another angle in. And I think what people really need to do, if we want not just the food supply available, but we want the suppliers making the food, we have to create markets for them. Because you might pay more for Bill's beef if you end up buying it after it goes through the whole process and ends up at Costco. Right. But Bill will make more money selling it through you than whatever 9 steps it takes to end up sitting in a case with, you know, plastic over it in a Costco thing. And they've gone and blade tenderized a ribeye. Like, for what reason? I don't know, other than to contaminate the inside of the steak. And you could be getting it 1 step from direct, basically. You've got 1 intermediary in what you're doing. And we need to figure out, how do we empower these producers? Because the only reason we went really downhill with our number of ducks is to do what we were doing the way we were doing it, we started to start hiring people and weren't making any money. But if I just had the, like, if I had met those people that I could use as a clearinghouse before we had started the scale down, we probably wouldn't have. If I could have had 1 place to sell 80% of my product to and then just take care of our 20-odd retail customers, that would have been easy. That would have made everything simple.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something that we've realized. Actually, listened to that same podcast episode last week. Randomly came across it. I was thinking the same thing. But yeah, the creating suppliers is a really big deal, because you know, we have a lot of people are a little more apocalyptic than I am personally, but a lot of people are worried about what's going to happen in the next few years or months or whatever. And the thing is, if something does happen, whether it's another COVID or a natural disaster or a war or whatever the thing is, it doesn't matter, depression, whatever it is, if those suppliers don't exist before it happens and that community doesn't exist before it happens, you're screwed.
Yes.
And you're playing catch up. You can try and you can do something, sure, but you're not going to have that system to fall on because it doesn't exist. And so what we need to do, and again, I mentioned at the beginning, people are becoming very complacent after COVID. They're calming down, you know, and that's, in my opinion, a very bad thing, because now is the time to build. Now is the time to make sure these things exist. You create them, you build them, you grow them, you make those connections so that when anything happens, and I'd love it if nothing happened, that'd be great. And if nothing happened, people are still getting healthy food. People are still doing good stuff. Community's still being made. You know, it's not like we need bad things to happen. It's actually worse for us if bad things happen, but we'll be able to make it, and we'll be able to make it so much better if we have these systems and these things and these suppliers and the farms and the people ordering from the farms. Again, we need that set up now, but in order to do so, you have to have some kind of structure. You have to have some sort of community so that you have the customers that want the stuff, so that you can make those connections direct with the farmer, so the farmer can actually scale up and make these things, have a way to unload them. Like, you've got to do all that stuff somehow. And there's a million different ways of doing it. We believe the food club model is one of the best ways of doing it, and there's a million different ways to do a food club model. But yeah, that's something that, given the times that we're in now, it's super important to get that going now and at least have it somewhat stabilized and somewhat in existence, so that if it's needed, you have that to fall back on and it actually exists in your area. You might not be able to order something from five states away if, you know, things fall apart. So, you know, from a prepping standpoint, that's one of the big tenets, is that, you know, you're not going to be 100% self-sufficient very easily. Sure, it's doable, but I wouldn't recommend it, and it's probably not going to work for most people. You need a community to some extent or another, and the same is true with things like food sovereignty, with things like, you know, basically just the broad idea of prepping as a community. You need to have these connections. You need to have these supply chains. You need to have these things, and you need them established before you need them. And so that's what we're trying to do, is making sure that they exist so that if they are needed, they exist. But then, like you said about capping members, that becomes the issue, is if you didn't create this thing, or if you didn't join this thing when it was open to everybody, and then all of a sudden things start to crumble and you need food and the grocery stores are out, like, what are you going to do? Like, we're full. I'm sorry.
I'm giving up my spot so you can have it. I mean, like, that's how that works. And then, yeah, if customers are loyal to a company, then companies tend to be loyal to a customer when they're this type. And I know it's not technically a company, but you know what I'm saying? Like, when you're running a business and you have customers that are loyal to you, and you're not, you know, being traded on the Dow Jones or something, you tend to be really loyal back to those customers. We've stayed in the duck business just because we have some retail customers that they literally can't eat anything else. I mean, you know, at least from an egg standpoint, the only thing they need is a duck egg with no soy. And that's as rare as a hen's tooth around here. Just because people don't either want to spend the money on the feed, or they don't want to do what I do and drive 90 miles to get it custom milled. They don't want to do that. So since I have that product. And, you know, this time of year, we're just coming out of the molt. The egg laying went to nothing. And my wife honestly feels bad when we tell a customer, we can't make the duck lay an egg. We can't go out there and go, do it. Or like, it doesn't work, right? You have to deal with that seasonal flow of up and down. We've done a pretty good job of talking about the upside of this as we get toward the end here. Are there any cons? Are there any things that, you know, are not that great when you're running a business like this?
Yes. Comment on the last thing you said first, though, is that the number one reason people join our food club is because of health issues. So like you said, like, people that can't tolerate, say, pasteurized milk, or they can't tolerate meat that's not pasture raised, or like myself, I had an autoimmune disorder I was diagnosed with that basically has no cure. You take this medication every day for the rest of your life, you know, on and on. And I did what's called the GAPS diet. And in doing so, it's a little complex and there's a lot to it and it's a big commitment, but I needed my meat to all be pasture raised. I needed my dairy to all be raw. I need a lot of fermented foods. I needed all these things that you cannot get at the grocery store. It's actually half of them are illegal. And so, if you need these things, that's where you get it. And it's the whole idea of food as medicine, which is another prepping idea as well. But yes, so yeah, lots of things, but going to the cons, the way that we are set up and the way most people would probably set up a food club, it is restrictive. So you're not going to have 1,000 people coming through every week, because that's just not what it is. And there are cons with that. It's harder to get members. It's harder to find people that are interested in being members. It's that convenience barrier. So what we've found is we've got kind of two types of members, and we have them both. So it's not like you're only going to have one or the other. We have both. So we have some members that were sourcing this type of food already. And those members were having to do a raw milk dairy drop at one place. They're having to go to the farmer's market to get some fruit. They were having to do some bulk orders and ordering online. They're having to do, say, an Azure Standard drop. They were having to, you know, still go to Costco or the grocery store to make ends meet. Like, they're having to piece together all their food, you know, find a grass-fed, grass-finished beef farmer, find a chicken farmer that does no corn, no soy, you know, whatever their needs were. They had to find all this stuff, and that's a lot of running around. That's a lot of time. That's super inconvenient, and that's very hard to do. And so when they found us, we're a million times more convenient for them. We save them all this time, and we actually get it cheaper, so we even save them money, and so it's wonderful. However, we also have members that were going from a more traditional lifestyle where they were getting most of their food at the grocery store, and maybe it was organic, but the grocery store is open all the time. It doesn't matter when it is, what day it is. You can go to the grocery store, and they're going to have
everything. Late tonight, you're not going to be leaving the office till 9 o'clock. You swing by at 9:15, go into Albertsons, they're open.
Yes. Yep. And so it's super convenient. So then they come to us, and the food club is only open 2 days a week, and you've got to order your stuff a week in advance to guarantee that we're going to have it. Maybe we'll have it even if you didn't order it, but maybe we won't. Things like bread, you know, eggs, things like that, depending on the season, sometimes we run out of. We'll fulfill our orders, but if you didn't order it, it might be a gamble as to whether we'll have it by the time you come in. And so to them, that's more inconvenient. Now, a lot of people, again, mainly medical issues is the most common thing, but a lot of people, that's still worth it. They're still members. They still love the food club and come in. But again, if you think about your average person, the average person that's addicted to convenience is not going to join a food club. They're just not going to. They have to have that level of commitment, and it's got to stem from somewhere. So for a con, getting members to get over those hurdles and some of those convenience issues can be a big challenge. Another thing is, it's debatable, I guess, with a PMA structure, private membership association. Some people say that a PMA should not advertise to the public. You're a private organization, so therefore you don't advertise to the public. Now, others disagree and say that you can, and not worth debating. But there might be limitations like that, where if you're not open to the public, you know, again, you don't have the foot traffic, you might not have the eyeballs on your stuff. Also, with what you're dealing with, like for us, we're dealing with things like raw milk, custom slaughter meat, things that are legitimately illegal to sell in a store. Yeah. And just because we're doing it legally doesn't mean that that doesn't get the negative agency eyeballs. Like, they don't care. They just see that, hey, you're doing this and that's illegal. We're shutting you down. And, you know, again, just because we could beat them in court doesn't mean we want to go to court.
Yeah.
So we're not plastering stuff all over social media. We don't have a social media account. We got a website. And up to this day, right now, we are 100% word of mouth. We don't even have a sign at the road. We've got nothing. And so even when members first find out about us, they'll usually email us and ask, you know, so how do we join? How does this work? And then we've got to describe what the building looks like because they have no clue where we are.
I don't know where it is.
And so to us, we like that. We're under the radar, and that's great. But again, that's a big con because, you know, we're only reaching so many people. And so a lot of the things are both pros and cons at the same time. The other thing is the, like, money to time ratio. So if I were to make this a full-time job, which currently we have two representatives for the food club is how we're structured. So the food club is an association of members. And then currently we have two people that represent all the other members. And when you sign your contract, your membership contract, you say you're delegating the responsibility to whoever the representatives are to make choices for you, to spend your money, to do all the stuff. And so that's how we're set up. And between me and the other member, we still put in probably 60 hours a week. and it depends. We're still building stuff. We're doing things. So we're putting in more time than we would to just run things.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a minimum of 40 hours a week to run a food club. And yes, if you want to do 40 hours a week and say $50,000, $60,000 a year works for you, that can work. And there are other ways of making more money. But again, you're not getting rich on that. And it's probably going to take you a few years to build up to that point, to build your membership, because you have to build it slowly, and to get things going, to build up your suppliers, to work out any kinks. So there's that time issue of how long does it take to get things going and up and running? How long does it take to get to the volume that you need to make whatever it is, the money that you need? How do you want to split up those duties? If you're doing it by yourself, you know, what if you get sick one week and you're physically driving to farms to pick up food, but you can't do that that week, but you have these members that are counting on their groceries? Like, you got to think about that stuff. And so, like, that becomes a bit of a challenge as well. And then, you know, just like a business partner, how do you find other people that can fulfill those roles and partner with you in running this thing that you can trust, that are like-minded, that are able to do so? So a lot of that is people that might be doing it on the side. But if you're doing it on the side, you're probably not going to want to put in 40 hours a week, and you might not be able to be there multiple days a week in the middle of the week during work hours. And so a lot of that becomes, you know, a big challenge of how do you actually make this work? Like, yes, financially it can be viable and it's a good business plan from that standpoint. But the actual implementation and getting it going and keeping it going, and how do you do that and working within these various parameters of the private sphere and these types of things, there's a lot of challenges in that. And then even in dealing with these farmers directly, I would say it's a plus that I am the one vetting the farm. I am the one going there. I see their farming practices. I ask what's in their feed. I actually know the guy that mills the feed for half of our farmers, and he mills our feed for our pigs as well and our chickens. And so, like, that's all good, but that's a responsibility I have to do. So I have to know my stuff when it comes to the feed and what questions to ask. We even had a random thing recently about got a guy that makes yogurt, and it's raw milk yogurt. It's good. It's healthy. He makes a vanilla one, and we made sure that the vanilla one was not sweetened with sugar, but sweetened with either honey or maple syrup. And so he did that for us. That's what we had. But the one thing that I forgot to ask the first time and then figured out and asked, and now we've made sure, is he using vanilla extract or imitation vanilla? And it's one of those things where, like, it never crossed my mind at first. But it's those little things, like, what's in the seasoning mix in the sausage? How are your animals being raised on pasture? Is it truly rotational, or are you rotating around on pure dirt? Are you rolling a chicken tractor across the yard and that's all they're getting is the dirt, so there's really no benefit? Or are they truly eating grass? It's like all these different things that you kind of have to know your stuff when it comes to farming and ingredients and health. And I don't know everything, but I have learned a whole lot and I'm still learning. And that's a responsibility that I have to fulfill this role, because I am the one that's vetting these farmers. I am the one keeping track of them. So again, as far as cons are concerned, those are a lot of things that we have to consider, we have to overcome, we have to figure out. But again, a lot of them, they're cons, but on the other side, they're also pros if this is the way you want to do things.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll do like a lightning round and go quick, because we're at like an hour and 40 minutes almost here. But how has the general reception been in your local community when, like, is this rolled out and local people found out about it?
In general, the local community doesn't know and or doesn't care.
Okay.
It seems like people think it's a great idea. They're usually very positive about it. Oh, that's really cool. Oh, healthy food. Yeah, we like healthy food. Oh, that's great. But they have zero desire to sign up and commit to anything.
Yeah.
The average person still thinks that $8 a pound for ground beef is super expensive, even though that's like less than organic at the store and it's actually grass-fed, grass-finished. And so, yeah, in general, like, no one cares. And so far, it seems like kind of state agencies are the same way. They either don't know about us or they don't care, which we don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say, and there's a question on marketing, so I won't go deep, but, like, if I was going to market at all, first, you have a website. SEO just makes sure people can find your website. Is it marketing? Not really, but it is, right? Like, it is search engine marketing, but it's not a full-on marketing effort, like a targeted marketing effort. So it would be good that people could find, if they look for Chattanooga Food Club, could find you. If they knew what they were looking for, they could find you. That would be one way to angle that. But there is a certain, like, a security through obscurity. Like, if you're not that big, most of these people leave you alone because they have other things to be doing to justify their existence, right? Like, it's when people flaunt it, I think. And I'm not saying they shouldn't be able to. I'm just, you know, a bunch of times when you were talking today, I thought about how many times I've used the following phrase in totally different scenarios, but this one too. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Right? Like, you know, like, and I think you still want to be right, but do you want to be right to the exclusion of your happiness? Like, that I can do this, damn it, no one can stop me. And, well, maybe they can't, but they can ruin you. And I think, like, thumping the nose of the bureaucrats is probably not the way to go here.
Yeah, yeah, totally agree. Yeah, don't want to poke the bear. I don't even want the bear to see me. Yeah. I just want to do my thing, and we're all happy. And you mentioned marketing. Like, another thing is, if you've got a system like ours where we have classes, and say we have a class on regenerative farming or a presentation.
You're marketing that.
Meetup groups. Yeah, everybody there is a potential target member, and they're, you know, they're like-minded. And so you can funnel people in that way, in a way that's not actively marketing, but it's so much more effective because you have them in person. They're super interested in what you're doing, and you know they're the exact type of person you want. So like, your conversion rate is going to be way better than a random Facebook ad.
It's like running an event to talk about technology investing so that you can form a relationship, so you can solicit investments from people in the technology field without soliciting it publicly, because now you already have an association, so the FTC can't go blowing up your butt, right? That it's the same formula on a much smaller scale. All right, let's take some things. I think you hit this, but maybe hit it real quick here for Nicole. She said, I wonder what adding a layer of ministry does to the protection side. Would you say that gives you more protection?
Much more. I would say, especially where we are in the Bible Belt, the agencies do not want to take a church to court over serving healthy food to members in a food ministry.
Yeah.
I would say that is the number one protection we have.
That's proof on a stick. I don't want to touch it, right? Like, no, here. No,
And that's not even, I mean, legally, there are plenty of protections with that as well. But, I mean, just the optics and the PR, I think, is the number one thing.
Yeah, that's just above where you, like, the next level up you don't want to touch is like an Indian reservation. Like that.
Yeah.
You talk about third world politics, but it's Social Security. No, that's an Indian. You don't want to even be seen as touching an Indian reservation. Nicole says, Josh, are you coming to the roundtable discussion about this with Alan Booker at SRF?
I am planning on it. I just talked to my wife about it today to make sure that was doable. We'll be out of town like the day before, and I think I make work anyway. So yes, that is my plan, and I'll get with Nicole and work that out. But yeah, it's sounds like the topics are exactly what this stuff is, and sounds like it'll be a great panel.
Justin says, does your food club accept Bitcoin? If so, does it have any limitations or unexpected benefits?
Kind of. So that's one of the great benefits is alternative currencies. So we have had people give precious metals. We have had people use Bitcoin. We have not set up a multi SIG wallet that we want to do all the cryptos. I just haven't gotten to it.
Yeah.
But that's one of the things. If you're a credit-based system, you could take any kind of currency, and then just internally it's credit-based according to, you know, it's dollar-based basically.
Mm-hmm.
But you can input and output whatever currency or thing of value you want. So again, great flexibility and great privacy issues when you use that.
The new old man says, do you have advice? Seems that means like people aren't motivated to grow anything. Find new. I'm not really sure what his question is there.
I don't know if you get that, dude.
If you want to restate that question before we end, you can go ahead. That's not a question. That's like three half questions put together. Houston says, do you purchase a cow from the Mennonites and hire them to milk and take care of the animals? How you run your herd?
We've done both. Usually, for the most part, we would just do a traditional herd share agreement with them where we own a portion of the cows.
Okay.
We actually have another agreement with one. They have one family cow, and we pretty much own the cow, and they milk it for us. So, you know, we can customize that how we want. But traditionally, it's usually just a normal herd share agreement.
Okay. Same dude says, do you have a walkthrough class on your model? Like, That might be another revenue model, how to do this.
Yeah, so currently the rough plan is that I can open up and do consultations, and, you know, you could scale that however we needed to, but do a custom deal where if someone's interested, I can talk with them, I can help walk them through the various things. Like, we've been through it all already about software and suppliers and all these various things. So I would like to do that. Like I said, there's one group about 2 hours away that I'll probably do a consult with them, getting them off the ground. And that's something I would be very open to doing and charging for. Currently, I do not have anything formal on that yet.
Okay. Wisdom of the Wood says, would you share, share the duck feed recipe you use? I have a mill 30 miles away who will customize. I used to have custom quail feed done there. So I don't, when I say custom mill, I mean, I have to call them and tell them what I'm buying, or they won't have it when I get there. So this is an actual mill. They package stuff up. They ship it to feed stores all over the state. And they have kind of a recipe for what I do that they sell to other people as well. This is what I can tell people about it. It is based on peanut and sorghum. It's 22% protein. It has no corn and no soy. So you would go to your mill with that as a base, and then they would figure out how to make up the variants. But it's when it gets wet, it turns into peanut butter. That tells you how much peanut meal's in it. And it has enough of a sweet smell. You know, there's a significant amount of that sorghum in it. And we feed pellets, so we do tell our customers it's soy-free, but technically it's got a little bit of a soy oil. They use a teaspoon of soy oil per 50-pound bag so the pellets will hold together. And I figure that's small enough. Most people, and everybody we've told, that's like, oh, that's okay. If you think about how little that actually is. AJ says, so you shouldn't advertise, but what about someone else talking about you on social media? And I told him in the chat, I think you're thinking the right way. There's a lot of ways. See, that is word of mouth, right? Like, as long as it's not you doing it, like, you know, if your customers do it, that's or your members talk about how great your club is or how great this club they're in is a way to go. And again, if I were marketing this to stay on the right side of it, I wouldn't be marketing raw milk.
Right.
Right. I wouldn't be marketing. We have, you know, anything that would even be in that gray market area. I would just say we have a local food club.
Yeah.
And then, because I think one of the, you know, when you're talking about the cons, one of the things I've thought about is how, it's weird, but people like want to buy like a little bit first to test the waters, and that's part of, you know, there's probably ways to use that for marketing. So we're doing a you know, 1 day membership for $5 for a tasting, right? Yeah. Something like that. It brings people in, and then, you know, then you have, again, you have that personal relationship. So now on, because I know one of the dudes, I think the guy you mentioned actually is big on these PMAs. What he got busted for was outside marketing and also marketing across state lines. That was how they built like the first case against him. I think that dude went to jail over that. And it was something to do with medicine. So that probably made it even worse. Like, it was in medical treatment or something. But I think there's a lot of ways to do this. And going slow and smart is probably better than going fast and reckless.
Yeah. And we do have members that are on various, like, usually Facebook groups and stuff. Like, the Weston A. Price Foundation is really good on healthy food and healthy diets. And there's various other groups like that. And typically, if someone gets on there and says, hey, where do I find, you know, XYZ, grass-finished beef, or where do I find raw milk, or where do I find this in the Chattanooga area? And usually, like, I get on there every once in a while. I'm not big on Facebook, but I have an account and I get on every once in a while. And oftentimes I see that pop up where it's like, oh, go to the Agora. Oh, have you looked at the Agora? Oh, check out this food club. And so we do have many members that are actively letting people know, funneling people to us. And yeah, that's not us marketing or anything. That's just word of mouth.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And somebody's asking me if the place is Tony's Seed and Feed. Yep, that's it. That's the one. It's 90 miles north of me. All right. Well, hey, man, I appreciate you being with us today. You want to tell anybody about your website or sites? I've got four of them here. I'll make sure they're all in the audio notes.
Okay. Yeah. I guess if anybody wants to see what we've got going on, theagorahub.com is the main one. And from there, we've got a link to the food club. We've got a link to Agora Ministries. And we have a link to the Chattanooga Voluntary Society, which is our local agorist group that meets up monthly. So you can check out all that stuff. If you're interested in more of the philosophical type things or the religious things, I've got a podcast. It's called Our Foundations, O-U-R Foundations, and you can find that on any of the podcast players. I haven't been as active in the past few months because I've been super busy for a million things, but lots of things on historical cycles and patterns and conspiracy and libertarianism and PMAs and just all kinds of stuff, agorism, basically.
I'll look that up and add it because it's not on the app. For folks that are watching the video, right down there in the video notes, there's a link that will go over to the audio version on my website. All these resources and other things that I've mentioned in the opening and outro, you will find there. If you click it this minute and you're watching it live, it won't work because we're not done yet. So it'll go up about 30 minutes after we end this live, which we're about to do. And again, I always have that link there in the video notes. If you're listening to this on audio, and maybe it's a few weeks have gone by and you want to find it, just go to the site and look us up. There's a search bar there. If you search food clubs, you'll probably find it because we don't have a ton of shows on that. But whatever you look for any individual episode on the website, EPI dash the episode number, we'll pull that one straight up with the search function. So, hey, Joshua, thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it, and hopefully some of your listeners got some good value out of it and maybe can get some ideas to use.
It was a great episode. I think we'll have some other people setting these up after hearing this. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah.
All right, folks, real quick before we wrap up, let me remind you a couple different ways you can help the show and the work that we do here so we can keep bringing you these great guests and this great content. One way to do that is to take some of our courses that we're building out over at homefoodsystems.com. And the much-promised cover crop course is done. It's not available for sale yet, and it's not on Tom. It's on me. I've got them all done. I got two more exams to finish producing. Get him those exams, and we can open that thing up for sale. And it is going to teach you how to improve your soil in ways you can't imagine. If you don't have a lot of really awesome local food near you, you can grow it for yourself. And if you have something like this, you can grow it for them, but it all starts with the soil. We do not grow food in reality. We do not grow plants. We grow soil. We don't even grow cattle. We grow grass, and the cow eats the grass, but we actually are growing the soil that grows the grass. It's all about the soil, and cover cropping is a great way to do that. I also have the compost course there if you haven't taken that one yet. And we have a principle-based permaculture design course. Compost course was our pioneering course, our first one. And so we sell that very inexpensively at only $40. It is totally worth it. MSB members get a discount on it. The principle-based design course is free. You can see what it's like to take one of our courses absolutely for free. The other thing you can do is pick up items that we review as affiliates. And the item of the day today is the Vivor 10,000 Lumen Rechargeable Flashlight. This is an awesome flashlight. There's a lot of them like it out there. There's really, I wouldn't say there's anything super duper, you know, super califragilistic, expialidocious about it or anything like that, but it's a damn good light. And what makes it an even better deal is the price. These things are about $20, folks. And that is a heck of a deal on this light. $20, and you've got a light with many different modes. It's incredibly bright. And it just works really well. I've got a video that explains the features on it. But the big thing it's got is, you know, the adjustable is just from pushing out or pulling in the head of the light. And that can be done with one hand. Very, very bright and $20. And they're on sale for like $16. And then you can get another 5% off with my discount code in the write-up, VV promo and my link. You get another 5% off. And then a listener emailed me this morning and said if you buy two or more of them, they give you another 5%. You can stack it with the discount. You can get 10% off if you pick a couple of them up. These things at this price are great. And one of the best things about it, I love lights that you would call like the Olight dual fuel or whatever. And this kind of emulates that in that it uses a 18650 rechargeable battery. And they're great batteries, but they are kind of specialized, and you can't just find them at any, you know, Eckerd Drugs or whatever if you need new batteries. But it comes with an adapter that will let you run it on three AAAs. And again, the light itself is rechargeable. You've got a little USB-C, and everybody should use USB-C going forward. Standardize on something, folks. We don't have to have 900 different cables. So, you know, any standard charger will charge it. if there's a negative, it's that the little USB-C cable they give you is short, and they don't give you like a brick to plug in. So most people have something to plug USB cables into. But, you know, self-contained, rechargeable, very, very bright, very, very effective, very well made at the price point of $20. So check that out. That is from Vavor on tspaz.com. You can find all my reviews, whether they're on Amazon or Vavor and what have you. And if I wouldn't use it myself, I wouldn't pay for it, I would not recommend it to you. And that's about it for the day. I really want to let you guys know, though, that I appreciate all of you for tuning into my show and for supporting my show. I appreciate you guys that have become members of my membership program. It pays for itself, but it also pays for the bills around here. So if you're not a member yet, consider becoming a member. Get the discounts. You can learn more at thesurvivalpodcast.com/members. Tomorrow will be an expert counsel Q&A show. I have a huge backlog, finally. I shook the piker tree, and summer ended, and the content rained down, so we are in good shape for really I need more content if you're a council member listening, but I know September I will not sweat getting the expert council shows done. We'll have that Friday flashback. We'll come to it again. We are on a short week this week. We'll also have another little cool feature being added to the MSB. I've gotten really big into sausage making lately. I'll be doing a class at the workshop that we're doing here in November on that. And as I've started building out these recipes, I developed a spreadsheet so that once I trial the batch and I want to scale it, all I have to do is change the pounds of meat and everything else adjusts. I started thinking about that and saying embedding a spreadsheet into a web page is really easy. So Tom, the web guy, has put together a feature set we're going to add soon to MSB where all of my recipes that I come up with that are like either sausage or other things with meat that have all these ingredients, you'll be able to access them as a member, no additional charge. You go in, you pull it up, tells you what it is. You say, I want to make 12.5 pounds. Boom, all those numbers come up for you. So that will be something we'll get added pretty soon. Again, thank you guys for tuning in today. And tomorrow I'll catch you with that expert show, but it won't be a live stream because we do not live stream expert council shows. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, the others will follow. Revolution.